Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We're just going to give it a few seconds while we wait for everybody to connect, and then we'll get started with our webinar today.
Mike, do you want me to have the video on even though it's just me?
That is completely up to you, whatever you're comfortable with.
Well, then I'll leave it off. If they're off, I'll be off.
Okay. All right, everybody. Well, thanks for joining us today. For those of you who don't know who I am, my name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on understanding the new debt collection rule in New York City. A new rule is set to go into effect in New York City later this month that will require debt collectors to notify individuals who do not speak or read English well about other options that may be available to them to help them understand their rights and communicate with those collection agencies. Today, we've got a panel of compliance experts with us to help walk through the rule and how it's going to impact your business. Before I introduce the panel, let me take a few seconds and say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is a news and information platform for the credit collection industry. I publish unique and curated content, publish a number of email newsletters, host webinars like this one, offer a number of exciting podcasts, manage a Slack channel, and do videos for the ARM industry. The site is completely free for everyone to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it's got to offer. Let me tell you now a little bit about today's speakers. Roseanne Anderson is the Chief Compliance Officer for Ontario Systems. She's responsible for driving the company's consumer financial law compliance program, designing innovative compliance solutions for Ontario Systems products, and leading the company's compliance consulting services and compliance outsourcing programs. Her two decades of experience in the ARM industry make her one of the most respected experts in the credit collection industry. Also with us today is Leslie Bender, who has spent more than 30 years handling compliance, regulatory, transactional, and legal matters for hospitals and financial services companies. Currently, Leslie is the Chief Strategy Officer and General Counsel for BCA Financial Services, a Miami, Florida headquartered financial services company. She is a past president of ACA International, serving as ACA's president in 2013-2014, and as an officer of its board of directors from 2011 through 2015. She earned her undergraduate degree from Northwestern University and her Juris Doctorate degree from the University of Notre Dame. Scott E. Wertman is a partner at Blank Rome, with a practice focusing on consumer financial services litigation, including individual and class action defense, regulatory proceedings, and administrative investigations. Additionally, he represents and counsels clients on corporate and regulatory compliance procedures in a wide variety of consumer financial areas. Scott is an active member of the New York State Bar Association, serving as chair of the Banking Law Committee and on the Executive Committee for the Business Law Section. The format for today's webinar is going to be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we will get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net's webinar recordings page. Finally, to make sure nobody gets in any trouble, let me read the following disclaimer. This presentation is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Legal advice must be tailored to the specific circumstances of each case. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area and should never be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. With that, let's jump into our conversation today. And let's start with, maybe Scott will ask you to walk us through the rule and what is going to be required of collection agencies when it goes into effect on June 27th.
Thanks, Mike. Before I go into the nitty gritty, I think just by way of maybe some history, back in 2010, the New York City Administrative Code was amended to provide the New York City Department of Consumer Affairs with additional powers regulating the credit and the accounts receivable management industry. This is the code that the new rulemaking is purportedly based upon. And it's just to give an example of what DCA typically uses rulemaking for. is the prospect of another way to regulate the industry with either licensing or subpoena power by increasing and advancing requirements. And to provide everybody the perspective, I think maybe I'll just give a quick anecdote from back in 2011, one of my first DCA, Department of Consumer Affairs administrative hearings, where I was representing a collection agency that was being accused by DCA of all types of wrongdoing, which was pretty much from the fishing expedition. And we get there to the hearing, and the administrative law judge is sitting there. And it turns out the administrative law judge formerly served as a prosecutor for the Department of Consumer Affairs. So we immediately asked for a recusal because the administrative law judge used to serve as the prosecutor, what the person from DCA is doing. But the person responded, the administrative law judge responded, sorry, that's not possible because every single administrative law judge here used to serve as a prosecutor for the New York City Department of Consumer Affairs. So I thought it was important just to give that example first so that we know what we're dealing with. The Department of Consumer Affairs is definitely not a friend of the industry. And these new rules, even those that seem benign, could be used or may be used by the department in ways to, let's say, increase subpoena power or pressure on their licensees. So, first, the rule, what it's trying to do, it's requiring debt collectors to inform consumers in any, let's say, initial collection notice or public-facing website of the availability of language access services provided by the collector, although some of that is unclear, and we'll talk about that, and also translation and description of commonly used debt collection terms. The DCA is also requiring debt collectors to request, record, and retain certain records regarding language preference. And also, DCA is requiring debt collectors to maintain a report. It's uncertain in what form, by language, the number of consumer accounts on which an employee of the collector attempted to collect the debt in a language other than English, and also the number of employees that attempt to collect on such accounts.
Okay, excellent. Good start. Thank you. And thanks for the backstory. I think that's very important as people understand where the DCA is coming from. We've already got some questions that have come in. So thank you for sending those in. If you have a question for our panel, be sure to type it into the chat box or the Q&A module and we'll get it asked.
Mike, I just thought I'd comment.
Go ahead.
Continue on with Scott's excellent comments here, though, is the fact that there are two areas in the new rules that are, by the way, one of us should make clear that there has a 60-day extension has been granted for the enforcement of this new rule. We'll talk later about what that actually means, but we do want people to take a deep breath if they are not aware of the of that modification to these rules, and we'll explain that again. But anyway, what I wanted to focus on was the fact that there are two areas that are specifically raised as areas where the debt collector needs to take affirmative action. One, Scott mentioned, it's in the validation notice about informing the consumers of any language services that are available, and the requirement to let consumers know if a translation of a particular document or disclosure, etc., is available. The rules also provide that in that validation notice, the debt collector must share that and refer the consumer to a translation of commonly used debt collection terms. And we're all waiting with bated breath what that means, but that they are available on the DCA website. As of Friday, they were not available. And I believe that the department, the DCA is actually not only working on developing the translation of commonly used debt collection terms, but also a frequently asked questions document. So a lot of meat will be put on the bones surrounding these new rules in the next few months. So I've mentioned the validation notice, and the only other one I wanted to highlight is the website disclosure requirement. Virtually identical to the validation notice requirement, but two pieces of information, or actually three, inform the consumer that if a language service, translation service is available, explain if they can obtain a piece of information, material, document, etc., in a translated format, and to let consumers know that the DCA will have a translation of commonly used debt collection terms in a variety of languages on their website eventually. Now, this is not to say that those are the only two times, in my opinion, that the DCA expects this issue to be addressed. And I'd love to know if my panelists, fellow panelists, agree or disagree. But because of the reasonable efforts requirement to make sure that you take steps to determine the language preference of the consumer, I believe that the validation notice and the website disclosures are just like table stakes, the place to begin. What do you guys think?
Well, Roseanne, I would definitely agree with you there. And I think that, you know, I think that that organizations are going to have to make some challenging decisions about what, if any, translation services you can reasonably provide. Are you going to have, you know, Google Translate on your website just the way New York's DCWP, I guess they're called now, does? You know, that's how they handle static translation. They have a translate button and it takes you through Google Translate. So would we be compliant if we did the same thing? I don't know if there are any vendors that offer web chatting in multiple languages or with something similar to Google Translate. But I think that once you make that threshold decision about whether or not you can provide those services, then things start getting really complicated. You know, for example, you know, we primarily service healthcare. So on any particular account, we might have a patient, and that patient might have designated other people to receive information about his or her care or payment for care. So do we need to know the language preferences of all of those people? And then there may also be legal representatives, medical proxies, responsible parties, guarantors in a healthcare setting. There could be half a dozen people who have legitimate business reasons to speak on the patient's behalf. And would we need to know all of their language preferences each time that we have some sort of an encounter? So I think that this is something that we all agree makes so much ethical sense. We want to speak with consumers, not only in a language they understand, but using methods they understand, you know, instant messaging, chatting, you know, SMS texting, whatever it may be. But how we know all those things and how far we go versus accepting translators that might be associated with consumers, the details are somewhat confounding here.
I agree. And you know, the Census Bureau, when I was just looking at the numbers, lists that there are at least, at minimum, 350 different languages regularly spoken in the United States. If you go on DCA's website, they have complaint forms in 11 languages. Now, the instructions are in one language, that's English, but yet they expect the industry, potentially, based on some of these ambiguities, to go much further than the city goes, much further than the state goes, or for that matter, any other industry goes in representing and speaking with consumers. Of course, it benefits. This is an industry that thrives on communication. Of course, we want to be able to speak to consumers, but this is punitive if we do it in a way that is considered unfair or misrepresentative or deceptive simply based on these purported rules. The one example which I look at is where after institution of the debt collection procedures, it's considered an unfair practice to continue collecting or attempting to collect on the debt without first requesting and recording the language preference of the consumer. What happens if the debt collector, is having a great conversation, forming an empathetic bond with the consumer? And oh, by the way, do you prefer speaking a language other than English? Yes, I prefer a language you've never heard of that you won't be able to find a translator for, or if you will, it's going to take some time. At that point, does the collector have to stop collecting the debt? It's unclear to me based on the way this is written.
Yeah, and I think we're getting some great questions in the chat box that are follow-ons to what you just said, Scott. So I think that one of the balancings you're going to have to do is, what is a UDAP? What is an unfair, deceptive act or abusive practice? And what is, you know, equalizing the playing field from a language standpoint? And if you take a look, for example, at what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says about limited English proficiency, they raise another issue that I don't think this rule speaks to, which is, what if English is my primary language, but I have limited English proficiency as an English speaking right. person, you know? And so, you know, we have seen in the supervisory highlights for years, which are enormously helpful in understanding regulatory approach, that any sort of consistent language, whether oral or written, that we direct our representatives to use is a plus, because we know that you'll always have baked in your compliance expectations. But to a lot of the questions that I'm starting to see in the chat box, you know, how do we balance what is a UDAP and maybe Roseanne, you or Scott have some ideas of where the guardrails might be on that.
Yeah, and picking up on that thread, there's one question here. Do you, any of you, feel that this regulation is planned to bootstrap further regulations? I don't know about whether it's planned to bootstrap further regulations within the city of New York or elsewhere. That would not surprise me. But what concerns me the most, and what I think is what this question touches on, is the fact that they have pretty much laid out for the consumer bar the formula for a false and deceptive practice violation under the FDCPA. And even though they don't, you know, they haven't specifically called it out in that manner, you know, they talk about it and then they trigger, it triggers violations. And Scott, I think, and possibly Leslie have much more experience in terms of the specific, you know, if you're really defending an action against the department. But nonetheless, when they talk about things such as it is a false or deceptive practice or misleading practice if your translation or partial translation is simply inaccurate where you provide the translation service. So if it's inaccurate, you basically are liable for committing a false or deceptive practice. And ironically, when you go to the department's website, and Leslie mentioned the Google Translation Service, a disclaimer comes up for the city that says, by the way, this may not exactly be entirely accurate, but it's a pretty good, you know, Google Translation is a pretty good estimate of what, you know, we're trying to say here, but it's not a guarantee. Yet, when it comes to debt collectors in this new rule, it sounds like you have to be very confident in the accuracy of your entire translation.
And yeah, I think there are...
Scott.
Oh, I was going to say, Scott, you're the obvious one to answer the question lurking in what Roseanne just said. Between now and 60 yeah. days from now, what will prevent someone from bringing a private cause of action here?
Well, thankfully, in New York, in the Second Circuit, there's the Gallego against Northland Group case, which is a fantastic decision. Kudos to Blank Room, my firm. But it's a case that stands for the proposition that a municipal violation doesn't automatically rise to the level of an FDCPA violation without additional conduct. Now, that doesn't mean that it can't be determined that separate and apart from municipal violation, there is an FDCPA violation, but many consumer attorneys have tried since Gallego to take the New York City Administrative Code and turn a violation such as a licensing type issue into a violation of the FDCPA. And the case law from the Second Circuit has been our friend in federal court in that sense. But my bigger concern isn't the private right of action.
Before you go to that, Scott, though, just to be clear, I wasn't saying a violation of the New York rule constitutes a violation of the FDCPA. I guess I was being more probative in that, does the mere fact that they've identified this language issue in itself, just the topical nature of it, suggests to consumer attorneys that debt collectors under the FDCPA, period, you know what I'm saying, should know or should be aware that it's a deceptive practice if the person cannot understand you because they don't speak English, I guess is what I was getting at.
Yeah, and I think anything that a consumer attorney looks at where there's the potential bill, where there's the potential of using the fee shifting provision that will put money in their pocket for what they may look at as a technical violation, where they could potentially use a putative class for leveraging a settlement, they'll use. And it wouldn't surprise me if we do see some actions. But my bigger concern here is the authority of the Department of Consumer Affairs. I mean, we've had many cases over the years. DCA, just like this rule, which we can talk about how there was really no notice. There was no, and as far as we know, there's no hearing. There's no transcript of a hearing. This is the first time that I've tried to get a transcript of a hearing of rulemaking and have been unable to. It simply doesn't exist. If somebody has it, please send it to me. I will be very thankful, but I can't find it anywhere. This is not the first time, though, DCA has threatened to take action against agencies without notice and a hearing. In fact, they've done in the past when it comes to licensing. And they're typically not looking to just simply give a slap on the wrist. They're fairly ruthless, and they made it known. I mean, they've made it known publicly that they detest this field. I mean, it's very ideological, and they play very much a self-proclaimed omnipotent role in governing the industry, but they usually do so without really having the prior experience and understanding of the industry. But they have a tendency of going through, let's say, the subpoena process for a group or for a company that's up for licensure or renewal, and then requesting an unrealistic massive settlement demand if they locate one violation. And my concern is they use this as just another way of looking for violations, demanding absolutely inordinate sums, and trying to once again put a dent, or more than a dent, in the industry.
Okay, excellent. So far, there are a lot of questions that we will definitely get to. But I would like to talk a little bit, Scott. We talked a little bit about sort of non-compliance. What are the penalties for not complying? You know, once we get past that 60-day enforcement moratorium that starts when the law goes or when the rule goes into effect on June 27th.
Well, depending on how the department interprets it, what it states at least in the rulemaking is based on the New York City Administrative Code. And depending on what section of the rulemaking the department is instituting the action on, the monetary penalties can range from $260 to $750 for a first violation, up to $350 to $1,000 per violation. And by per violation, the department has taken the position in prior litigations that a violation isn't the company violated it once because, let's say, it went out on 1,000 letters, but it's a violation. It's, well, how many times did the violation go out? Oh, 20,000? So it's 1,000 times 20,000. And at that point is where the other aspect of the penalty comes in. And this is a very big one for agencies that operate nationwide, and New York City has a lot of potential consumers, is the loss of licensure through suspension or revocation.
Okay, thank you. Roseanne, Leslie, anything you want to add on top of Scott's comments about the penalties for non-compliance?
Scott, you might just want to comment. We're getting several questions in the chat box about whether the rule applies to creditors as well, and whether a creditor could be held responsible for a debt collector's failure to comply. And, you know, I wondered if you had an opinion about it. It looks like the rule is pretty focused on debt collectors and debt collection activity, but maybe Roseanne, you or Scott have a different perspective on that.
Roseanne, feel free if there's
the only perspective. Like that. Well, the only perspective I have is the one from the local law for the city of New York, which talks about a debt collection agency in more traditional terms. I don't see that it specifically identifies creditors in the definition itself. However, it does specifically reference a buyer of delinquent debt. And it excludes any attorney at law or law firm. So unless there have been some changes to that definition, I think they're zeroing in on licensed debt collection agencies.
Yeah, and in New York City, they define, as they do in many places, debt collection agency very broadly. It does include purchasers of distressed receivables, does include attorneys. And as far as creditors, New York City, whether or not they have the statutory authority to do so, will occasionally try to either subpoena or attempt to bring administrative hearings against creditors, even creditors that are regulated by the OCC, which is federal. Those actions typically don't go anywhere, but DCA, they're on a mission as far as they're concerned. And I'd be curious to hear from them how broadly they're defining these new rules.
So Scott, I'm not going to let you off the hook yet. Some of the other questions that we're getting relate to legal collections. And so one thing I don't know, because I've never filed lawsuits in New York, but you know, in states in which I have practiced, courts themselves have translation services. So do the New York courts also have translation services associated with their activities, so that if a debt collector filed a legal collections lawsuit, the consumer would be entitled to ask the court to provide a translator?
Yes. Under the Office of Court Administration, New York, the court administration does provide translation services. The only thing is it could take time. I've seen cases where there's been adjournment after adjournment taking up a year's time just to have an initial conference for a certain translator. But yes, the Office of Court Administration does offer translation services.
So let's bring this back. I always think of myself as being in the audience. The specific question: is creditor included in the definition of a debt collection agency? And I said no. However, Scott explained that that does not mean the department will not use its subpoena power, correct? Is that a correct interpretation of what you said, Scott?
Yes.
Okay. And it does include a buyer of delinquent debt who seeks to collect the debt directly or through the services of another. So I would think debt buyers need to pay keen attention to these new rules. It also makes clear that an attorney at law or a law firm that's collecting the debt as an attorney, like they're thinking of it, like you're in your legal capacity. It says in such capacity and in the name of the client and through legal action and blah, blah, blah. They are exempt definitionally. Now, I don't know, as a matter of practice, I bet you would say, Scott, however, that would the DCA attempt to apply this rule to licensed attorneys who are acting in the capacity
of a licensed attorney, if you know what I mean, not as a debt collector?
They do. In fact, there was a case brought a few years back regarding this very issue.
Was that our Eric Berman friend?
Exactly. It's the Berman, okay. The Berman case. Okay. And in that case, the district court, I think, got it right as far as attorneys. I think they referred to DCA and said DCA should stay out of the legal business and continue regulating hot dog vendors. But then it was, I think, appealed, and they found that attorneys can fit under the definition of debt collector if that is their, if that is primarily what they do, and they use some other language. So yes, the New York City Administrative Code and DCA licensure does apply to attorneys that principally practice in debt collection.
Okay, so they're slicing that definition. And then the other thing I just wanted to make clear, make sure we all have, we have a consensus on, the New York courts, the DCA, other agencies within the City of New York may have translation services, but one of the questions posed is whether, well, really, are they just asking us to refer us to those kinds of translation services? And I would say no. They are expecting the debt collector to present, if they choose to present the availability of a language translation service. The reference to referring a consumer, let's say on the website or in the validation notice, to the DCA, I keep using the old reference, but to the DCA's website is for the is only for the limited purpose of helping consumers find translations of common debt collection terms. That does not substitute for the debt collector's duty to provide language translation services if they choose to, correct? We all agree on that?
Yes, I read it the same way, Roseanne. And okay. I think that they expect us to be, and there's a great question in the chat box, hey, we offer translation services. If we now put in our initial collection notice on our website that we offer translation services, will we have complied with the rule? And I think the answer is probably yes. I don't think the rule is saying you must do that. I'm saying, I believe the rule is saying you must tell the public whether you have translation services available or not. And if so, what they are, or give them some idea. But I read it the same way. Okay. The glossary and the reference back to the DCWP or whatever they're called now, their website, is just for that glossary and for an annual report form that is not yet available, which would help those of us who are compliance officers know what data we should start accumulating.
Right.
Yeah, it's also unclear to me. I don't think that, at least my reading of it, is that it's required for the collectors to offer language support in every single language, although you have to provide information related to the support you do provide, but it could be interpreted to mean something else. It's unclear whether debt collectors must offer language access support and to what extent. And the rules regarding disclosure of language access service, it is questionable regarding the prohibitions of certain conduct regarding those services. It doesn't specify whether or not in the rulemaking, whether those services are required, which is another reason why I think it's very important for the department who, again, there is no notice, there were no comments for the department to, at minimum, which I think they're going to do, put out FAQs.
One observation I would like to make is that, and Leslie, you're the pro when it comes to healthcare collections, but, or the expert, I should say, but the, many hospitals, when offering financial assistance plans, in particular nonprofit hospitals, they are required to provide translations, it's nonetheless to a limited extent to their population of consumers. And I think you have to hit a 5% minimum. So for every group, if you total up all the number of patients and every group that hits 5% of the total in terms of a language other than English, they have to provide some sort of a translation service to help these individuals navigate the healthcare system. I wish if an agency like the DCA has this appetite to mandate the use of these language translation services, that they would put some of those guide rails around it. Because otherwise, the way I'm reading it, and I bet we have some people in our audience who are wondering the same thing, the way I read it is that if you don't want to offer a language translation service for a what we would consider a rarely used language, you don't have to, but you're not going to be collecting that debt. Hmm. Isn't that kind of the essence of all this, without running afoul of the risk of some sort of an allegation that it's a false or inaccurate or misleading statement or a deceptive practice? So I think, because one of the questions is, can an agency simply avoid the reg by just only speaking to people who are proficient in the English language? And I'm not going to say yes to that because of all the other laws, but let's focus on that for a second.
Let's focus on that for a second, because I think that, you know, when the CFPB published its debt collection exam handbook, I think a lot of people were surprised to see Reg B or the Equal Credit Opportunity Act included. And, you know, most placements that we receive from our clients don't give us any information about whether the patients are members of a protected class. So an interesting question would be, would you possibly have a disparate impact, not intent, but impact, or maybe intent, where you've got a Reg B problem because you are essentially redlining anybody that doesn't speak, let's just say, Spanish or English or whatever are the languages that you are proficient in or offer communications in.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a whole world of hurt outside of, you know, some of the things that we're talking about. I mean, obviously, you know, we'd all agree that not speaking to consumers in a way they understand or they prefer is not going to work to our benefit. One of the questions in the chat box is, what if you don't know a consumer's language preference? Well, if you don't know, but you made a good faith effort to try and get it, and I would be interested, Scott and Roseanne, if you agree, if you don't know, but you made a good faith effort to get it, and you can recreate how it is that you try to learn that, I think you're okay under the rule. What do you guys think?
I think you're okay under the rule based on my interpretation, but it doesn't say in the rule exactly what reasonableness means. And my concern always with rulemaking where there hasn't been an opportunity for the industry to put in comment and there hasn't been a hearing and there are no FAQs, is it's uncertain to me what is expected and what is considered reasonable by the department. And I just want to comment on before on what you said, and I think it was great, and it was something I hadn't thought of, is with regards to, well, what does New York law typically require in from other, let's say, from other agencies even? How far down the rabbit hole has DCA gone with this as far as putting this industry in a completely different category? And there is a an executive law that state agencies that provide direct services have to provide certain vital documents, and they have to translate them, but it's only in the six most common non-English spoken languages by individuals with limited English proficiency in the state of New York, based on U.S. Census data. So again, it's another example of this rulemaking going well beyond what any other administrative agency and what any other state agency needs to do but our industry yet somehow is expected to.
And the other thing, it's interesting when we really drill into this, in terms of the reasonableness, my personal comments about that would be this. It's something more than just the validation notice disclosure and something more than just the website disclosure. I don't think it's every 3 minutes you have to have a recording that says, by the way, what language do you prefer? By the way, what language do you prefer? I mean, it doesn't have to become like an abusive part of the conversation. But I do think, and here I'm being a little facetious, but I do think after you've given the mini Miranda, after you've explained that the call may be recorded, after you've determined whether anyone may possibly be impacted by COVID-19, you will have to pay some attention to their language preference in some order. And I'm not sure it's possible you have to do it before the mini Miranda, because what's the point of the other disclosures if they don't understand it? But anyway, I just want to make sure that I want our audience to understand we feel the pain. Some of these questions we just simply do not know the answer to. But for me, the reasonableness is really part of your talk off, making it for the people when you're collecting in New York City that you just, when in doubt, ask.
Right, but you want to be careful not to tip the scale to the UDAP side, right?
Right.
Like, you don't want to go through your inventory and look for surnames.
Oh, God,
and
no.
Make assumptions. And, no. You know, if somebody is on the phone that seems to be, not able to understand you or speak English or Spanish or whatever language your collectors are speaking, you want to be very careful about those kind of circumstances. I saw a series of draft FAQs that have been floating around, and if somebody's speaking perfectly fluent English on the call, then how does that work in your calculus, Roseanne? You know, like,
mine would be confirming that this is your language preference. Just stop making a big deal out of it.
Yeah.
It's interesting. If you think about it in the converse as well, person, you're right, is speaking perfect English to them. The person subjectively believes they're speaking perfect English. Your collector, on the other hand, believes there may be a language barrier. And then asks, oh, very innocently and benign asks, but what's your language preference due to these rules? And then all of a sudden, again, do you have the potential disparate impact? And there's a host of issues here.
How do you have a disparate impact if you ask everybody to confirm what is your
language? You don't if you ask everyone. But if you're only asking individuals that you believe may have a language issue or speak language other than English,
right,
then that would be a disparate impact. But if you're asking everyone, then the question again becomes, you're having a conversation with a person, they're speaking perfect English back and forth, yet you have to ask the question, by the way, what language do you prefer? Because the language, it says preference. It doesn't say what language do you speak. So let's say the person prefers a different language. What then?
Right.
What is your collector supposed to do?
And you've just taken me back to my original question. You know, in the healthcare arena, we typically have a patient and a responsible party on every account.
Mm.
Now, they may be the same, but they may not be the same. And what if those two people have different language preferences? The patient has a responsible party who prefers English, but you have that indicator. Another thing we haven't talked about the rule, I want to make sure people notice, is that theoretically the rule is requiring you to keep a log of the communications you have with consumers and the language in which those communications occur. Now, if you have accounts where you have 5-10 conversations in addition to 2 or 3 letters, that's a lot of data you're now accumulating that you may not be accumulating today or even contemplating being in a spot to accumulate in 60 days. Do you guys read the rule the same way?
I read the rule exactly the same way. And it's going to be difficult as far as keeping track of those kinds of statistics, and it's also unclear exactly what the department is looking for. It seems to me every time a debt collector collects an account and there is a different preference of language in English, the collection agency is required to have some type of delineated record for the department's, I guess, statistical purposes.
The one question I hope that, I agree with you, I interpret it the same way. The one question I hope is addressed is kind of bad faith on the part of the consumer, because part of me is that as lawyers, we can dissect this thing to the point that it's laughably absurd. Maybe it doesn't take lawyers to get to that point, but nonetheless, their point is, I know what their point is. I think we all do. Their point is that it does not help if someone cannot speak English, I will go to an extreme, to speak to them about their rights, about legal action, you name it, setting up a payment arrangement, if they have no idea what anyone is saying. I mean, that would be I would guess that's what this is trying to address. The problem is when you introduce the scenario where the person is speaking what we would all, like any jury or any judge, trier fact, would all agree, this person seems to have control over the English language, yet they have preferred French. Okay. And since they mentioned French, the French language is their preferred language. And if you don't have a translate, now you can't collect from them. Is that the idea? Or it'll be a deceptive practice. So on the other hand, so there's, I hope that in the new rules, in the frequently asked questions, and that they insert some reasonableness on that side too. I mean, if they say, that we have to exercise reasonable attempts to obtain the preference, I think there should be some reasonableness with regard to the to our interpretation of the preference. You know what I mean?
And I think that's a really good point. And I think lurking in that point, Roseanne, is another point that merits discussion. And that is, what if you have multiple accounts for the same consumer? Right. Not just stuff in process. And we have two or three questions in the chat box. What if I'm already in the midst of litigation and I've been dealing with a customer for 6 months now? So my question is, what do I do today? If I already have 12 accounts for somebody in my system, and today they tell me they need to only have communications be in Spanish, what do I do with the other 12 accounts? And then what do I do for future placements? And do I have some duty to notify my clients when they place more accounts? Hey, did anybody ever talk to this patient in Spanish? Because they're telling me that that's their preference. Or what if they need their communications in sign language or Braille? How do I incorporate that?
Well, at least that would give us ADA coverage. We'd have some guidance there, I would think. But I don't think language preference, you know, I agree. It's a serious problem. I would like to know, do you think there's a chance in what you say, any hotel or whatever, there's a chance that this rule will be simply defeated? Because if you push it even one further step, I mean, how many English to English speaking people don't understand each other because of accent, tone, volume, you know, you name it. All kinds of things can come into play in terms of why we have impediments to communication. It's not just the choice of language. So do you think there's any chance the city of New York would rethink this mandate?
I don't think that they're going to necessarily rethink the mandate unless there's pressure applied regarding the constitutionality on the rulemaking process itself. Okay. Otherwise, I think this is going through, which is why when they use the term with the 60 days, it doesn't stay the rule from going into effect. It simply stays enforcement.
Okay. I agree with that. Because I also think there's been a very, other than the curious path where the rule was proposed 2 days before Governor Cuomo's state of the emergency was declared and the hearing was held during that state of emergency, that curiously not one comment was filed. Forgetting that for a minute, they've been very methodical at the DCWP, and they published last fall their findings in surveying just under 1,000 agencies about their limited English proficiency preferences and experiences. And so I think that this has been planned pretty methodically for a period of time, and I would think it unlikely for them to step away from this, because it just seems very methodical to me.
Yeah, I think the department plans on just, when it comes to administrative deference, just shrugging their shoulders to really what amounts to new legislation disguised as a rule, which started in the middle of a global pandemic and supposedly ended after a hearing, which not one person I know of attended or knew about. And once again, a hearing where there's no transcript of the hearing that I can find that exists anywhere.
Conspiracy theorists unite.
Right. I was thinking the same thing.
I wish it just was a theory, but there really is no record of the hearing other than a statement that the hearing took place.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm aware of some groups that have made Freedom of Information Act requests. So there's some other interesting comments or questions in the chat box. There's a question about, does this change how we should feel about allowing consumers to have their own translators? Heck no. I think, and this is just my own opinion, I think it's a great idea that part of your policy is that you invite consumers who have translators to authorize those people to participate in conversations. Again, bearing in mind, under a lot of laws, including my favorite one, HIPAA, you know, there are some rules about third parties being part of conversations unless it is clear that they have permission to be there. Which we haven't talked about because I didn't want to take us down my favorite rabbit warren on this call. But I love the idea that part of the policy you adopt, because let's face it, there's some people in the chat box that have suggested, hey, what if we just tell people our policy is we can only speak Spanish and English, or we can only speak English or English and French or whatever are the languages. Well, does that feel like something that if it's out there in the credit ecosphere, that something could go wrong with that information somehow in some future? You know, back to the conspiracy theorists, it just feels like something could go wrong there if you put that out there, but that might just be me.
No conspiracy required. We all have seen the websites operated by consumers and self-proclaimed consumer attorneys that pretty much tell people how to bait collectors into violations. Well, how easy would it be to say, well, if you want to get out of a collection call, just claim that your preferred
right
language is and just say so, because you've already gone onto the website and you can see what services they have. So I agree with you. I think that's something that could very well and probably will happen.
And that's the piece that I thought was, if there's no reasonableness introduced on that side,
right,
or that, then this is, well, one thing that the reason I asked about, might they either retract it or seriously modify it, because the Americans with Disabilities Act, it's all about accommodating the needs of the audience. So, you know, you can't use, and even the new rules proposed by the CFPB talk about, it has to be screen reader, your information on your website has to be screen reader friendly. You know, you can't use, I don't know if the colors are red and green, but there may be some others as well that are not ADA friendly because of color blindness and other issues. And you have to have, you know, descriptors of the video of any photograph so that people who are not able to see, you know, can hear and listen to the description. So anyway, it's all about accommodating people. I wish this was more, the onus was put more on the consumer to take advantage of, please take advantage of translation services, because it's really seems out of whack to me that it has to be the debt collection agency that becomes the expert in all of these language, or they have to walk away from that business.
But. Right. And what happens if the underlying credit that was granted was in English, but now, mm-hmm. you know, the consumer doesn't speak English. So essentially you're speaking for the creditor about some of the terms and conditions of the underlying credit. Right. So it could get.
And what if you've got passed through TCPA consent from the creditor and that was accomplished in English, and now you find out the person doesn't speak English? Does that negate all your consents upstream?
Yeah, it gets tricky pretty quickly.
It gets very, very tricky quickly.
Well, we've just about run out of time, although I imagine the three, you know, I could continue listening to the three of you keep going on about this for a while. I'm sure everybody else could. You've done an admirable job getting to as many of the questions, I think, as possible. But before we wrap up, maybe what we could do is go around the panel one more time and allow each of you to share any parting words of wisdom, parting advice, any other conspiracy theories we have not yet floated, want to get out there before we run out of time. We have mentioned it a couple of times, and I will say it one more time. They are working, the DCA is working on a set of frequently asked questions, along with a number of industry groups that is expected to hopefully provide some clarity. So we will definitely be on the lookout for that and hope that that provides a lot of answers to the questions that people have been asking. But maybe we'll just go give our panelists one last chance to share any other information or, you know, sort of summarize what they've talked about today. And maybe we'll go, Roseanne, you can go first.
All right, thank you. Well, and by the way, Mike, I didn't say this earlier, but for goodness sakes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Thank you for inviting me to participate. It's been a pleasure, Leslie and Scott. My parting words would be just an observation of a little data point buried in the middle of this, the new rule, that after you do institute debt collection procedures, whatever that means, let's hope it means the delivery of the validation notice. But it says, after the institution of debt collection procedures, collecting or attempting to collect a debt without first requesting and recording the language preference of the consumer is a deceptive practice. So I would say, as we move forward, if you collect from individuals in the city of New York, I would make it part of your routine script to request with the consult of your legal counsel and the people who approve your scripts and your talk-offs, but to pay attention to how do you first request and record their language preference.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Leslie?
Well, thank you also. What a privilege to be able to be on this panel with Roseanne and with Scott today. So thank you, Mike, for this opportunity and great questions in the chat box. My parting suggestion would be for folks to get involved with their trade associations or their, you know, all of whom are looking at frequently asked questions right now and proposing answers. And if you have questions you feel it is imperative that you get clarification on, that you let your associations know so that they can add them to the list. So thank you so much.
Excellent. Thank you. And last, we'll go to Scott on the grassy knoll. Scott.
First, thank you, Leslie, Roseanne, Mike, and everyone joining us. This was a really interesting, compelling discussion and has given me a lot to think about. A few thoughts, hopefully, to provide confidence. Because a lot of the times I think in these situations, of, you know, as lawyers, we're analyzing it. And I think it's important also to provide some positives and maybe an outlook that's where maybe the grass can be greener. This is a rulemaking where there potentially was no notice or opportunity to be heard. And there is the possibility that if they do try to use it, let's say against a against a member, against an accounts receivable management member or group, that this could be challenged as far as the constitutionality of the rulemaking. Furthermore, we've already seen with the Department of Consumer Affairs where they try to single out a group, and in this case, it would be our members. This could be a violation of what's known as an arbitrary and selective enforcement, which the U.S. Constitution protects us against. And this is under the 14th Amendment and can be brought under Section 1983. And what we've seen is that the perceived intent to injure, simply based on adverse and unsubstantiated stereotypes, such as the arm industry, could conceivably be an impermissible arbitrary classification. And DCA has gotten into trouble with this in the past. It would not be the first time for them. Finally, I just want to say that if you already have a license with the Department of Consumer Affairs and you receive some type of a threat from them that they're going to pull licensure unless you do A, B, and C, if it seems unreasonable to you, it probably is. And just take note, and you may have to comply, but that once the government has granted a license to a company, the government can't simply deprive you of that interest without first taking appropriate due process procedural steps. And that's all.
Well, excellent. Well, Roseanne, Leslie, Scott, thank you so much for your time, your insights, your willingness to address what is a complicated and fluid topic. I can't thank you enough on behalf of everybody who asked questions and on behalf of all of us who learned something today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everybody else, thank you for your participating today. Thank you for your questions. Stay tuned. We've got webinars tomorrow on whether or not the FDCPA is constitutional under the First Amendment. We've got a webinar on Wednesday about negotiating tactics, including a negotiation expert will be joining us. Thursday, talking about leveraging technology to boost your agent's productivity. And Friday, we've got a really special webinar with a couple of consultants and a representative from the industry talking about how to foster a culture of diversity and inclusion in your office, which is an incredibly timely topic. So you'll find links to register to all of those on accountsrecovery.net. I hope you all take a minute and do that. And we'll definitely look forward to seeing you soon on another webinar. Thank you. Thanks again, everybody. Take care.